Welcome and thank you for joining us on the Stay Healthy South Sound podcast, where we want to give you tips on staying healthy and even expose common myths about health and aging so you can enjoy a healthier and active life in the amazing South Sound. Brought to you by Dr. Jennifer Penrose, owner of Penrose & Associates Physical Therapy.
Welcome to the Stay Healthy South Sound podcast. My name is Dr. Jennifer Penrose, and with me today is Dr. Richard Lamour, who is an orthopedic surgeon at Olympia Orthopedics that specializes in the foot and ankle. So thanks so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So today our focus on the foot and ankle and how to keep our feet healthy, pain-free as much as possible and lasting a lifetime, as well as identify some common ailments that people have and what can be done to help. So to start off, Dr. Lamour, tell us a little bit about your background and where you went to school and how you decided to specialize in sports medicine and particularly the ankle and the foot.
Well, I'm originally from the East Coast. You know, I did a lot of my training there. I did my undergrad at Johns Hopkins Medical School at Ohio State. Did my residency in orthopedics at University of Miami. And then after that, I did a sports medicine fellowship at the James Andrews Institute in Gulf Breeze, Florida. And there, it was a great experience to take care of a lot of athletes, Auburn University. And then went on, did a foot and ankle fellowship in Las Vegas. And then I was out in practice actually in California. And then I met my wife. She's from Portland, Oregon. And then we decided to kind of move up here. So the opportunity arose here in Olympia, Washington. And we jumped on it, and it's been a great decision ever since.
Yeah, I was wondering how you ended up in the Pacific Northwest after all those sunny places. Yeah, so your wife.
Exactly. Gotta keep mama happy.
That's right. Great. So let's talk a little bit about one of the most common things you see in the clinic. So I would think ankle sprains would be at the top of the list.
Yeah, it's a very common injury. One of the most common injuries we see in sports in general. So I see a lot of ankle sprains, and they vary from obviously lower grade sprains to high grade sprains, and the treatment, you know, varies. There's a variety of treatments, obviously. I find myself kind of being a little more conservative now, seeing that there's a good population of people who continue to have difficulty after, you know, ankle sprains. So I find myself just kind of slowing people down, you know, trying to, especially for the folks who have the moderate to higher grade sprains, trying to slow folks down and mobilize them in a boot or a cast, allow them to get some initial healing for the first couple of weeks or so, and then getting them into some therapy to begin rehabilitation. And so those folks don't end up as, you know, having chronic issues, you know, months down the road.
So yeah, let's just spell that out a little bit more for our listeners. When you say to slow them down, like in terms of having them not move quite so much.
Correct,
or yeah. Brace them a little longer or boot them a little longer so that then the tissue and scar tissue can kind of get those ligaments to kind of tauten up a little bit. Is that exactly?
That's exactly what I mean. You know, those ligaments on the outer side of the ankle, when they tear, they're like little rubber bands. You know, when they tear, they can heal up on their own, but we just want to position them so they heal in a nice normal length position, good normal tension. As opposed to where some folks, maybe they don't get formal treatment. They just kind of have a significant sprain and they just kind of move along and push through. And then that joint that is experiencing all the stress of walking or just returning to sports. And now that those ligaments that are supporting the joint, they heal in a looser position, almost like a stretched out rubber band. And then, you know, folks can have, you know, continued pain or instability because now those ligaments that normally are like a check rein keep the joint stable, they are looser, allowing more motion and allowing it to roll more easily.
Right. I do think patients often come in here with an ankle sprain, at least that I see too, that they're so petrified of scar tissue and lack of mobility that they do, it's almost like that pendulum swing where they've heard like, oh, you don't want scar tissue and you don't want to get stiff. And it's like, well, if we only do this for a short period of time, it's going to help things heal in the right position so that the ligament can function the way it needs to and you won't have something that's overstretched hanging around. Like I find myself having to educate that piece
right
quite a bit because they get so fearful of scar tissue. It's like almost a swear word.
Right. Yeah. No, I've had a couple where I have to kind of dispel some myths that folks already have or some misconceptions they already have. So I think there's immobilization earlier on is not bad if it's for a short period of time to allow the initial inflammatory phase to settle down, the swelling, the soreness, because trying to do a lot of movement during that time is just sometimes it's painful and it's just not, folks are just not ready for it.
Right. You need to let some of that healing happen. Yeah. I find myself having to do that too. So then in terms of when should a person consider seeing a specialist with an ankle sprain? So far they're thinking it's kind of a normal thing and they're kind of following the timeline. At what point should they see somebody for it?
Earlier on, when you first have the injury, if you're having pain significant enough where you can't weight bear or it hurts to weight bear, then you probably should see someone to make sure, get an x-ray, make sure there's not an associated fracture or no associated tendon damage, other ligament damages that could occur. But if you're able to kind of walk away from the injury and kind of, if things aren't getting better after a good 2 to 4 weeks, then you probably need to investigate further to make sure, there's not an associated injury that's lingering that's causing, you to have persistent symptoms.
How many go on to become chronically unstable? That's usually when you and I end up seeing more people. So like in terms of all the ankle sprains, like is there a certain percentage that we know goes on to be chronically unstable?
That's a good question. I mean, I haven't seen that in the literature. However, what's quoted is a good 30% of folks will have continued pain and instability, but not all of those 30% are chronic instability patients where they have just the lax ligaments, but maybe they're just having pain. But I would say this is what I see the majority of the time, I would say it can be up to 10% of, all of these ankle sprains could end up having chronic instability. Not all of them need any type of surgery, but where they just have continued, instability and their ligaments just feel loose.
And what are some things that then they try for intervention and treatment, and what gets someone all the way to potentially needing a surgery, and then what kind of surgery would they?
Typically, the treatments earlier on are bracing, physical therapy. We send them to you to kind of rehab them, get them strong. From a dynamic stabilizers, get their dynamic stabilizers working to help maybe compensate for the static instability they have where the ligaments are just loose. So, so obviously PT, bracing, really those are the main things. And then when folks, despite bracing and therapy, they're still having instability, then we start talking about surgery.
The Brostrom technique, or what is more currently that you're doing, is that?
So there are tons of different techniques. I would say now the more popular techniques are the techniques that are focused on anatomic reconstruction of the ligaments, recreating the anatomy, as opposed to some of the non-anatomic reconstructions we were doing previously. That had some additional side effects. So I think for the most part, we're focusing on Brostrom-type techniques where we're just kind of shortening the ligaments, maintaining the anatomy, not rerouting tendons like we used to. And then some of our newer techniques were able to kind of strengthen the repair significantly from time zero, where we can begin rehabbing people a lot quicker. So my goal is that, after their first postoperative visit, about 10 to 14 days after surgery, they already have their therapy visits already set up, and they are, starting PT at 2 weeks, 1 to 2 weeks after the surgery.
And then for those that have to have that, how many months is it before they're really feeling like, all right, this was a good decision, I'm back to walking and hiking and even more advanced?
Everyone is different, but I would say routinely for our active, relatively healthy patients, I would say at 3 months, people are getting back to most things, unrestricted sports and, higher demand activities.
That's what I've seen in the clinic too. And it's usually the patient is ready, like they've tried everything and their ankle's just been giving out and more, and they need that stability because the compensation methods are not working for them. But that surgery on a whole seems to be fairly positive, the longer term outcomes.
Yeah, no, they definitely have been good. And then I would say really good. There's some new studies coming out showing that the internal brace device, which is the device I was kind of alluding to, that is increasing the strength of the construct, is kind of like the seat belt on the repair. And it all really is the same things we've been using, but just in a different configuration to kind of give us a check rein or a seat belt to keep our repair from stretching out too soon. So we can begin therapy early without the worry of the ligament stretching out, which we don't want to do right away.
Right. And does the reconstruction use some sort of synthetic, like what materials, is there any material added to those ligaments?
Not necessarily added. It's just the same suture materials we were using before, but they are kind of in a different configuration. So instead of like the sutures, the sutures kind of flattened out, almost like a little, like a band, 2 millimeter band, but it's the same suture material. So we can avoid having to use allografts that we were used to doing for the bigger reconstructions. So
let's move on to Achilles tendon. So are there risk factors for people that end up tearing their Achilles tendon? Are there things that kind of put people in the at-risk category? Because there's some common stories that I hear from patients, like they'll feel some symptoms kind of coming on prior to the event.
Definitely having some pre-existing, non-insertional Achilles tendonitis can predispose you developing Achilles rupture. So where that midsection of the Achilles, that area, unfortunately, like a lot of tendons around in our body, like the mid substance of the tendon is an area where the blood supply is not the best. And that's the area where when you have overuse, when you have overuse injuries or just overuse activity, tendon gets tight, you start getting this tendonitis. Then the architecture of the tendon changes, you get this thick bulbous mid substance of the tendon, and then that area can rupture. So then that many times folks have that before to some degree. And then you also have the component of folks who are, doing an activity or participating in activity, they're a little deconditioned. And that's the ones I probably see most of the time, like the weekend warrior, 30 to 40 year old. And we'll just get like a wave of them in the springtime where people are, the weather's clearing up and they go out to do stuff and they rupture because they're deconditioned, not warming up before you go do stuff. And you just, it just ruptures because the tendon stretches too much during that time and it just gives.
Do you feel like those people also have tighter calves, tighter Achilles tendon too?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a over tightness of the Achilles tendon and the calf muscle is something we're seeing. So definitely have been, emphasizing that to patients as far as stretching, good stretching program, warming up before you do any of those activities, running, sports, to make sure that those tendons are limber. But tightness of the Achilles is definitely an issue.
A precursor almost. Yeah. That's at least the stories that I kind of hear too. They almost feel like, yeah, I felt tight that whole week.
Yeah.
And then insert whatever activity they went and did that was a little more aggressive.
Some of that is maybe a little bit of tendonitis that was going on. So, it's a little inflamed, a little angry. And that usually tendonitis issues presents itself as tightness of the tendon. You get up in the morning, first few steps, it's tight. You got to, so.
Yeah. So some things for people that they could do that are listening to the podcast from a preventative point of view is if they are feeling some tightness back there, they should kind of listen up and start stretching. I even tell some of my runners, they might be seeing me for something else, but to just palpate, like feel their own Achilles tendon and move it back and forth. And if it's really tender, they should start massaging and stretching and doing some preemptive things to potentially head that off. Because sometimes you don't realize how tender it is till you go poking around on it.
Exactly. It's very true. it's just already kind of like a sensitive spot, but there are some folks who don't even notice it. And then you touch back there and it's like, oh, that hurts. I mean, but that is definitely a component that is going on.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I've been telling me was like stretch more, especially my running population is like, if you can stretch a little more, warm up longer, if they're in the 40s and up crowd, we just don't, the Achilles doesn't get good blood flow. So I just think people don't recognize that.
Very true.
The tendonitis, if we want to back up a little bit before the rupture and the repair work that you have to do and the whole surgery piece of it, when they have Achilles tendonitis, they typically start out with having some pain after the activity, right? And then it happens where they're having pain during activity. Is there a timeline that you give people for returning as they're into therapy or when they see you and like, when can I run? They're always like, when can I run? When can I run? What kind of timeline do you kind of give them?
It's kind of hard because everyone's different, and there are varying degrees of tendonitis. I usually, my kind of rule of thumb is that you have to be able to do certain things without pain before you can progress. So if you're walking without pain, then, you really can't return to running. And then once you start once you've kind of got back to walking and spending, you know, a day of, you know, doing all your daily stuff without having pain, then you can start advancing your activity to running, and then in an incremental fashion. And after you've, you know, you're able to run half a mile, then a mile without any pain, then you kind of start ramping it up from there.
Yeah, that's usually what I tell people too, but it's always the common question.
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to always say like, hey, it's going to be 6 weeks, it's going to be 12 weeks. It's like, it's kind of hard to say. I mean, everyone's different, really.
Yeah, I feel like people can, it depends on how quick that tendon wants to respond and how inflamed it is. So when you do have to repair it, do you want to talk about that? There's been some change in that in your line of work of being able to anchor that in a way that allows for an accelerated rehab compared to what it used to be. So do you want to kind of talk about what you do now and how that has been able to move a little bit quicker?
So traditionally, you know, Achilles tendon ruptures when you do have a rupture. And, you know, we talk about, you know, non-surgical options, surgical options, and non-surgical options are definitely is a good option for certain patients. We know from the Canadian literature, European literature, that the, you know, the non-surgical option is like I said, is good. But for, you know, I don't think it's for everyone. I think for the really active person trying to return to higher level sports or just higher level even recreational activity, the operative option is you know, I just think it's better. It gets people back a little bit faster. And now with some of the newer repair techniques which we're talking about, the surgery can minimize some of the risk factors that were there traditionally. You know, before you always see this long 12, 16 inch incision sometimes, and the wound complications that can occur. But now with some of our new repair techniques, we're able to minimize these incisions to just like a couple centimeters, 2 to 3 centimeter incisions to get a good, strong repair. And so we're getting a good repair, avoiding the wound complications, avoiding a lot of the, you know, complications which having a larger wound, nerve potentially injuries. And the repair I typically do is one where we're suturing the top part of the tendon and bringing it down to meet the bottom part of the tendon and passing these sutures through the tendon and then anchoring it into the bone where the tendon is. And that by anchoring it, we're kind of getting a stable, basically space for the ligament to heal in this normal length. So we know that this tendon is going to heal. It's just a matter of if it heals short or heals long. We know that not from the all our non-operative patients, we see that the tendon's going to heal. It's just a matter of whether it heals, you know, with too much, you know, length, and then we lose our push-off power because now the muscle tendon complex has been elongated, and now we don't have the recoil.
Right, it can't effectively push off if it's too long.
So, so that's where the surgery is basically recreating the length tension relationship to this muscle tendon complex, as opposed to, you know, doing a bigger procedure where we have to bring the ends directly together and stitching them together, which we don't necessarily need to do. We're just kind of bringing the top part to the bottom part, well, and then bypassing the you know, the bottom part by putting the anchors in the bone.
Okay, and the anchors that go in the bone, are those, is there metal involved or just sutures again? Just sutures.
These anchors are absorbable anchors. So okay. They're biocomposite. So they almost, if I were to show it to you, it almost looks like a drywall anchor. So it almost looks like plastic. It absorbs. It takes a while for it to completely resorb. Takes
How
probably
long?
Over, you know, 8 to 12 months or longer for the entire thing to absorb. But you're not able to see it on the x-ray. It just kind of completely resorbs. And, you know, there have been, you know, in other instances where I've had to kind of do a revision and we've used these same anchors for other problems, and we've seen that the anchor is like completely gone. Your body's kind of resorbed it.
Okay. And then while it's going under that period of time of absorbing, can the person actually feel those anchors? Like if they point to, like,
no.
if they feel pain at that insertional part in recovery, right. It's more just pulling the tension pulling on the tendon.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's the, exactly. So it's the tension of the sutures that are attached to the tendon pulling on the bone. So that's where the early rehab, you may get some of that anchor pain because we are, because the, you know, the tendon is pulling on it. And you know, technically things aren't completely healed, but because the construct is so strong, we can begin earlier rehab and not have to put you in a cast for however long we traditionally would do.
That's what I've noticed on the rehab side. Things move pretty quickly, really well. But if there's any complaint from the patient, it is, they can feel the anchor.
Yeah.
And I've wondered about that. So it is, and that's what I thought. It was just the tension.
Yeah.
Pulling.
And that is, from a surgical technical tip, it's more of like, you know, we've changed the anchor positions to take less tension off of the bone. But that's just for our really technical listeners who want to hear about
right.
that.
Right. And they should be back to sports if everything goes well. When would they be able to go back to playing sports versus the old method and versus the people that elect not to have it done and just go in the boot for a while? Like, what are the different timelines there?
Yeah. So if we take the same patient, because I always have to kind of equate to the same patient, because everyone approaches rehab differently. We have our patient who's, you know, college athlete, rehabbing really hard, trying to get back to, you know, obviously playing sports. In that case, we have folks go back to playing sports at 5-6 months after this type of, you know, repair, which is a, you know, quicker side. You know, for traditionally, it could take 9 months, and I really hadn't had too many folks go back to, you know, a competition before like 8-9 months with a bigger open repair. And then non-surgically, you know, I really don't have too many non-surgical active patients, you know, college athlete type patients, if we're trying to compare apples to apples.
Right.
But just kind of comparing some of maybe the more active, you know, patients we've done the or offered the non-surgical treatment option, and that would be more like 12 months or longer before they're really getting after it, doing a recreational activity that's a little bit more intense.
So we are going to take a little break to hear from our sponsor before we move on to another topic.
As a listener to this episode, Penrose Physical Therapy is currently offering an introductory rate of $60 for a massage therapy session. This low price won't be around long, so contact Penrose Physical Therapy at 360-456-1444. That's 360-456-1444 to schedule your massage therapy session today. And don't forget to ask about our package specials and monthly memberships when you call to schedule your appointment. Penrose & Associates is also offering a free knee pain workshop on October 17th from 6 to 7 p.m. RSVP is required. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Penrose Physical Therapy or sign up for our email list on our website at penrosept.com to keep connected with our offerings and to help you stay pain-free and mobile. And now, back to the show.
Now, we're going to continue onward with plantar fasciitis because I don't know about you, but that's a common thing that enters my doors.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the usual symptoms and location and potentially point out what other things people really could have for heel pain, because I think sometimes people, you know, they do their own search online and they Google heel pain and, you know, everybody has plantar fasciitis when sometimes that's not necessarily what they have. So kind of go ahead and let's talk a little bit about usual symptoms and location and then what other differential diagnoses they should potentially be aware of.
I see a lot of plantar fasciitis, and it's kind of like a blessing and a curse because it's one that's just super common. And the blessing is that it's going to get better. And the vast majority of the times, you know, patients don't need surgery, but at the same time, the recoveries to get back can be a while and sometimes a little unpredictable. Typical location for pain is in the inner part of the heel, bottom part of, you know, plantar medial section of the heel is typically where folks have the pain. Classically, you can also have pain that goes into the mid-body, more into the mid-portion of the plantar, of the arch in the foot, yeah. And you can get some variants where you have lateral band, plantar fasciitis with a lateral band, the outer part of your lateral heel can be a little more, you know, aggravated more than the typical central band medial, plantar medial area. You know, that's kind of the common location. Usually folks will have pain getting out of bed, first few steps in the morning, the foot's tight, there's heel pain, first few steps from being out of seated position, getting out of the car, getting up from work, and then just being on your feet for a long period of time. So those are all common, you know, complaints, symptoms people will mention to me that are kind of described classically.
Mm-hmm. It's a hard area to treat and it seems like it can be caused from various factors, like the plantar fasciitis person that has the flat foot type versus another one that has a very high arch stiff foot. They can both have plantar fasciitis.
Yeah.
But they have two different causes really going on.
Right.
And my treatment is a little different in PT with those people. So it is interesting to me. What things have you seen that seem to help the most? Have you seen that too, where it's different depending on their foot type?
Yes. You know, I think, and it'd be interesting to hear what you do differently for those different foot types. Aside from, you know, typically how I approach pretty much everyone with plantar fasciitis, no matter their foot type, they're starting off with aggressive stretching program to work on stretching of the heel cord, stretching of the plantar fascia. Those two main stretches have been researched, have shown that they've helped. And they usually, I recommend them doing those two stretches, plantar fascia specific stretch, you know, typical runner's calf stretch for the first 6 weeks, doing it multiple times a day for, you know, several days and up to 6 weeks before we say, hey, this is not getting better. And then I give folks a handout with those stretches and the information. An orthotic, you know, you typically an orthotic. If you have a significant flat foot, then I will recommend getting a custom orthotic, because an over-the-counter one may not just be enough. So if you have a fairly neutrally aligned foot, an over-the-counter one can get the job done. And then if you have a significant cavus foot, then a custom orthotic also can be helpful, because it, you know, an over-the-counter orthotic may not be enough for, you know, really high arch foot. So that's how I usually start off, with orthotic, stretching. Other things you can consider adding on are like night splints. Those type of little devices can be helpful, but that's how I usually start off. But there's a ton of other things that folks will mention, ice bottle, you know, ice water bottle.
It just numbs the pain, I think.
Yeah,
exactly. I don't know how effective it is, but if it numbs the pain.
It gives patients something to do. And I don't, it's, you know, it works for some people, works for other, it doesn't work for others. I usually say focus on the exercises. If you want to do more, then you can do those other things. But yeah, I just focus on those two main exercises and the orthotics, and then kind of go from there.
Yeah. I find the flat arched people really do need some kind of insert. And I have some off the shelf ones that if I look at them standing in that and we can get away with it, I'll let them do that. But if they really do need the custom, it's just not enough. And then that's where they need to go. The high arched feet, they almost need that, the support to meet the arch, but more shock absorbing and not a stiff, rigid insert. Or it's like taking a stiff foot and putting more stiffness in there, and they don't like it. So I guess I varied a little bit with that, and the flat arch person, trying to get them to do some intrinsic foot strengthening a little bit to help support that plantar fascia area on top of stretching. But yeah, stretching, it seems like that the tightness in that calf and Achilles almost sets them up a little bit. That's what I've found. And then just, you know, depending on where they're stiff on that high arch foot, if I can get some mobility in different parts of the rear foot, midfoot, if I can help get movement going, it helps to seem to take some pressure off that insertion of that plantar fascia. So some hands-on techniques sometimes are helpful, or taping, that kind of thing. But it's interesting, the two of them, they both get plantar fasciitis, the flat foot and then the stiff high arch, but for, it seems like a little different reasons. I don't know.
Yeah, I've noticed that. And also with the flat foot, there's this component of, you have the plantar fasciitis, but then because of this, you know, medial thrust of the ankle, like the ankle's rolling in, you have this hind foot valgus. You also get almost like a compression neuropathy of these, you know, of your posterior element, your posterior nerve. The plantar, lateral medial plantar nerves get compressed. So there's a level of tarsal tunnel that's going on too, that contributes to the plantar fascia, which is another diagnosis where they kind of overlap as far as their symptoms and, you know, and then their presentation. So just being mindful of that too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like looking at people walk. And if I see something that just doesn't mechanically look good, it's like, all right, what can I do to post that or to help that and see if it relieves that pressure point there, whether it's the plantar fascia that's being irritated or whether it's, like you said, the nerves. But either way, I try to post that so that they do a little bit better. But I just think people need to know that, like, there are options and things to look at. Any other differential diagnoses people should kind of be aware of with heel pain that you mentioned the tarsal tunnel, like the nerves being irritated?
Although plantar fasciitis is super common, there are other, like, you know, mimickers, like, you know, calcaneal stress fracture. So that is definitely an entity there that can kind of masquerade as plantar fasciitis. Insertional Achilles tendonitis. Some folks may not be as, you know, describing the location, whereas at the insertion of your Achilles, which is more in the back part as opposed to the bottom part of your heel, sometimes that can be, you know, an offender. But those are some of the main ones. And then you get some other, you know, weirder diagnoses like, you know, compression neuropathy of like the Baxter's nerve, lateral plantar nerve. So those are all, you know, less common diagnoses, but other options as well, potential.
Do you ever recommend any like PRP injection? Has that been shown to be helpful in plantar fasciitis or more tendonitis stuff?
I've done it before and I've had some good results with it. However, it is not a routine thing. I would say I do. You know, the studies for it they're kind of all over the place. We're still, you know, working on good standardized studies to show, to compare, you know, with standardized methods for, you know, for obtaining the PRP to show whether PRP truly is effective, because some studies show it helps, some studies show it doesn't. It's not a standard of care thing. So I will, after that course of initial stretching, if folks continue to have difficulty, people come back. Most people don't, because most people get better. But for those handful of people, it just doesn't get better, then we try those other treatment options. And those other treatment options would be injections. The PRP is a good option. It's safe. And I've had, you know, a handful of people who've gotten better from it and have done pretty well, actually. So I think it's something I definitely do offer folks that.
I've seen a little more progress in that arena as well. Like, they seem to do a little bit better than the cortisone injections.
Yeah, the cortisone injections, it's like, I will try it once for patients, obviously, because, you know, our options are limited before we're doing something more involved. But I don't recommend doing repeated injections, because it's just, if it doesn't get better after one injection, one steroid injection, or the relief is just very short, then I wouldn't recommend repeating it.
Do you mind explaining a little bit like how the PRP works, so our listeners can understand what it's trying to do?
So basically, it's a biological approach to, you know, treating a lot of the tendonitis, you know, itis issues across our body. Plantar fasciitis is one we're trying to, heal, you know, get our bodies to heal it. So the platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, it's basically, we're isolating the platelets in our blood. So typically when you come to the office, we take about 15 cc's of blood, we put it in the centrifuge, and we spin it down. And by spinning it down, we're isolating the platelets in the blood. So we get like a little serum of platelets that are in the blood, and that ends up being about 2 to 3 cc's from that 15 cc's of whole blood. And then in those platelets are growth factors. And these platelets are little granules of growth factors that have the potential to help heal. So when we're injecting them into an area in a concentrated form, then we're kind of encouraging the body to heal these areas. So initially it can cause an inflammatory response, because you're bringing, like, you know, you're bringing all these healing factors, and that with the healing factors brings a little bit of inflammation. Folks can have a little bit more soreness and swelling in that spot for the first few days, but then that tends to calm down. So I usually will tell people that the recovery or the healing from that, the outcome, is going to take a while to kind of experience it, as opposed to like a steroid injection, where you're going to, if it's going to work, it's going to work pretty quickly and you're going to have a pretty good response. So, but this is more of a long haul type of treatment, trying to resolve the problem.
How about a word on Sievers disease? So there's those kids, it seems like kids in soccer,
yeah,
seem to get this, like the heel pain, but it's not Achilles tendonitis. In fact, do you want to explain a little bit more what that is and maybe why kids seem to get that in soccer more so than other sports, or at least I see more of it in soccer kids.
Yeah. So Sievers disease, or calcaneal apophysitis, we have an apophysis, basically like a little section of bone by the growth plate in the heel, where you have your Achilles attached to it, and you have your plantar fascia attached to it on the top and the bottom. Basically, the thought is that it's a growing pain, you know.
Yeah,
exactly. So as the bones are growing, the bones are essentially growing faster than the soft tissues, the tendons, and that are attached to the these bones. So same thing, the Achilles tendon, the plantar fascia that are attached to this calcaneal growth plate area, they get tight, and that just kind of causes pain. And unfortunately, it's one of those things where there's nothing terrible going on. The x-ray looks normal, or the x-ray will show some signs consistent with Sievers, which is a little bit of density in the bone, but nothing terrible, no broken bones or anything like that, no real concerning abnormalities. And the typical treatment for it is stretching. It's all supportive stuff. So stretching, orthotics, sometimes it involves just taking it, you know, taking some time out of sports just to cool it down for those really severe cases.
Yeah. I found that those soccer kiddos, if I can get, I have a pretty good 3/4 insert that'll fit in those cleats, and I get that in there, and they really, I think one, it gives them the Achilles a little slack. Yeah, yeah. It gives a little height. And then it also controls that. It has a little bit of a heel cup, so it controls any kind of pronation, because there's hardly any arch support in those silly cleats.
Yeah.
So it just takes the edge off that pull, I think, on the heel from the plantar fascia, potentially if they're a pronator. And that seems to keep them a little bit happier, on top of doing a good stretching program of the calf and the plantar fascia, and then just giving it time. I mean, that's pretty much all I can offer.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, yeah, but I found that to be a little bit helpful. But I just think it's interesting. Those soccer, there's something about those soccer cleats.
Man, it's kind of funny you mentioned that, because I have that discussion with young athletes, high school athletes, even college athletes about their shoe wear, the soccer cleats, their football cleats. They're like track shoes now. They just make them thinner, lighter, for the marketing. And I just remember my playing days, just, you can almost feel every stud that you're stepping on, because they're just so, there's not much support there. So that's why I really encourage them just to put it, just get, even getting an over-the-counter insert inside your shoe, just to get a little bit more arch support inside the shoe to make these shoes a little more supportive.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they've come a long way. I mean, I have a couple that are designed for cleats, and I have some that, if that's not quite enough, a 3/4 one, I can still get in most cleats off the shelf that works pretty well. The kids are happier.
Yeah, sounds like we need to get those lower profile inserts to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's move on a little bit to like arthritis. So both in the ankle and in the foot a little bit. What's a typical story for someone with ankle arthritis that comes in your doors that you see? What's some of their symptoms and presentation and things that they've already tried? And
so for ankle arthritis, typically, the most common cause of it is some post-traumatic ankle arthritis. So they probably had some trauma in the past, ankle fracture, and then, they, healed up from that, and then years go by, and then it starts to kind of be a little more symptomatic gradually. And then it can get to the point where it's debilitating. Like, I had someone the other day come in the office, and she was telling me she can't even make it down to the mailbox because she's just having so much debilitating ankle pain. Obviously not working anymore because of her ankle pain. So it can get that bad. Obviously there are varying degrees of it, but that's kind of the timeline usually we see with those. It takes several years to progress, but when it's bad, like any other joint, it can be debilitating.
And then when it does functionally get that bad, does it usually correlate to with what you see on the x-ray? Like it looks.
Typically, I mean, there are some folks who have, typically when when you have pretty significant arthritis, the symptoms are advanced. But every once in a while, you have some folks who come in, I look at their x-rays, and they have bone-on-bone ankle arthritis, but they're here about something completely else, something completely random, and I'm just like, this doesn't hurt you. Apparently not. But in other cases, the arthritis is more on the milder side, but it's just causing severe pain. So as long as the pathology is there, there's abnormality, then I usually don't kind of restrict certain treatments to certain folks.
And then when they do get, so what are their options then at that point in the ankle? If they have arthritis in the ankle that's debilitating, they functionally are not doing well, what are their options at that point?
So initially, for most folks, if I'm seeing for the first time, usually just trying to make sure that we kind of go through all the non-surgical options to see if they can get better. Bracing, steroid injections can give good relief. Usually my goal with the steroid injections are that, if you can get a good 6 months out of a steroid injection, it's reasonable to consider repeating it every, 1 or 2 months, every 1 or 2 times a year. But if it's giving you less relief than that, then I don't recommend repeating it too frequently, because it's just not, it can just cause deleterious effects to the joint. And then anti-inflammatory medications, typical stuff, oral anti-inflammatory medications. Topical sometimes can be helpful, like topical gels and orthotics can help position, especially if there's a deformity involved to help offload an area. You know, bracing can be helpful just to kind of provide more support. Or some of the initial, and physical therapy can be helpful too, just to kind of get the the muscles and tendons that cross the joint to provide additional support, that dynamic support.
Right.
To the joint.
Yeah, because if they haven't been walking, they're more than likely getting weaker.
Yeah.
So then, at what point would a replacement be an option next?
So, yeah, this is where we look at the X-ray. We assess their symptoms, and usually I tell folks if you're, you know, when do you decide to do, you know, surgery that, you know, whether it's fusion or ankle replacement, because both of them are still good options. I have that discussion anytime we're talking about severe ankle arthritis and we're doing a considering replacement versus fusion. We have that discussion. But basically, we talk about how, you know, it's time to consider surgery when your daily life is affected. You're having difficulty with sleep. You're having difficulty with just, you know, doing everyday activities, difficulty potentially with shoe wear. When it's really limiting you in that regard, then it's time to start, you know, talking about surgery to improve your quality of life.
Right. Yeah. With the fusion, are there some that when you look at what determines to do a fusion versus a replacement?
So not everyone's a good candidate for ankle replacement. You know, unlike total knees, total joint, total hip replacements, you know, towards the ankle, we can have issues with as far as healing that are specific to the distal extremity as opposed to like the knee and the hip. So if you're a diabetic, particularly a diabetic with neuropathy, you know, that a replacement is a contraindication. You really should not be having that. You know, if you're, you know, super morbidly obese, you know, right now BMI recommendations are usually if you're over like 40s, kind of want to get that down to under 40, under 39 is one what most of the studies are saying for ankle replacement. However, you know, that is a little bit more of a relative contraindication as far as size, but you know, definitely want to be mindful of that. But then when it's time to consider replacement versus ankle fusion, and, you know, some of it is, you know, the age also, you know, doing an ankle replacement in someone younger than their early 50s is the sweet spot age for ankle replacements is between 50s, 60s, and up, because, you know, survivorship, how long is ankle replacements going to last, is not as good as knee and hip replacements. You know, our technology is improving. Studies are coming out there showing that ankle replacements are lasting longer. Right now, most currently average survivorship is anywhere from, you know, 10 to 15 years, depending on which ankle replacement you're using. But it was less. I mean, it was, you know, 8-6 years. But you know, we're definitely improving. So we want to make sure it's going to last you a long time and not going to need any revision.
Yeah. I've had more ankle fusions in my clinic than I have replacements. And I'm assuming it's because that just people don't fit the criteria. Yeah. And they do, the fusions do really well. I mean, their pain is gone. They're able to walk. They're doing, there's certain things they can't bend their ankle in certain ways and get down to a deep squat kind of position on that side, but they do function pretty well, which is what the surgery is designed for.
Yeah. And you know, there's going to be more ankle fusions because traditionally that's what we have. I mean, that we had historically ankle fusion is what we offer to patients. We didn't have as much ankle replacement options, but definitely we're getting more and more ankle replacements. I'm doing more ankle replacements now, offering it to more patients now that we have just more better technology, better implants.
And then the foot arthritis, I've definitely seen several in the last year of just the triple arthrodesis in people, those particular patients I had prior to them getting the surgery, and they were miserable. They couldn't function. They really didn't want to have surgery. But then afterwards, they actually really wish they would have done it soon. Like, you know, they basically were like, I kind of lost 2 years of my life that I can't get back because I kept putting it off and just very fearful. And it was just, you know, when the joints are that bad and you've tried everything, you got to get to that point where you can kind of accept it in your head that that's where you're at. And so I just was amazed. Those people did really well. So I don't know if you want to comment on that.
You know, the some of those fusions I really love doing, especially when folks come in and they have like a, you know, terrible arthritis, severe deformity. And I'm just like, man, I'm just kind of like, I won't say licking my chops, but I'm really happy because I know I can get them better. And I know the surgery is going to help them because it's a bigger surgery. It's a longer, a bit of a recovery, but, you know, usually I tell folks, you know, when you get to the point where you're 3-6 months out from the surgery, you're going to be really happy with it because you're going to be able to get back in a shoe, doing a lot more things that you maybe weren't able to do, a lot more standing, a lot more walking. So, and from there, it'll continue to improve. You know, those type of surgeries take up to, you know, 12 months to completely recover from. But I really like doing because, you know, particularly for those patients with the larger deformities, significant arthritis, they can really be a life changer.
Yeah. Yeah. Those ones I really feel like they come to PT hopeful, and we might try a custom orthotic and working on gait mechanics and some exercises, but really some of them, it's just so, the arthritis is just so bad, I can't be as helpful anymore. And they do so much better after that. So that's been really great to see, because I feel like that one was a really, really successful one. Bunions. Let's talk about that. I have a lot of people with those, and I'm curious what the latest and greatest is on that.
Bunions are, bunions sometimes are challenging because, and despite getting the toes lined up or getting the big toe lined up, and you know, sometimes they can still have some challenges with some stiffness of the joint. Because traditionally we would do an open procedure, open exposure, a lot of stripping of the soft tissues to kind of get to do the osteotomies that we normally would do to cut the bone, shift it over. So that, and then whenever you have a procedure where there's that's open, large exposure, a lot of soft tissue stripping, there's just going to be more pain, more swelling. It's more difficulty. So I'm excited right now because we recently been doing more MIS or minimally invasive foot and ankle surgery. So we have this newer technology that is able to allow us to do these bone cutting procedures, but in a minimally invasive fashion. So we're all doing it under X-ray guidance. So for the past, few months now, we've been doing these procedures, at our facility and noticing significant improvements as far as hallux valgus. So having patients come back and they're at the 2-week follow point, I just saw one before I came here, 2-week follow point, just four or five little poke hole incisions, take the sutures out, and, we have some swelling, but it's typical postoperative swelling, able to move the toes pretty well, walking in. And just mentioning that, hey, I didn't anticipate it was going to be this. I didn't think it was going to be this painless. So these past several patients have been mentioning that. So it's been very encouraging. So I think it's going to be a game changer for hallux valgus and bunion deformities, because before it was just it was a long recovery, and that was one of the things I would counsel patients, that the recovery is going to be long. It's going to help, but it's going to be long. It's going to, and the rehab is going to be kind of hard to get your toes back. Get your toes back, that motion.
Yeah. And that's what I've always struggled with people with the traditional bunion surgeries, is they come in and they're already stiff. They're coming in, sometimes 4 weeks, 6 weeks after surgery. And it's very hard for me at that point to get their movement back, and they're swollen and they're still painful. It's, it hasn't been something that people are eager to sign up for.
Yeah.
Because I don't think the outcomes have been that great.
Overall the outcomes, are good. But even I notice, it's like, we want to do surgery where people are kind of back quicker, faster. And for bunion surgeries, really, I found myself, talking patients out of bunion surgery more than I was talking into them. But I think now with some of our newer techniques here that we've had acquired more recently, that this is going to be a change where we're definitely going to be the outcomes are going to be better.
At what point, people start off with having a little bit of pain with pushing off, let's say they're a runner and they're noticing a little bit of pain, a little bit of stiffness, but it's not horrible. And they're doing a little bit of they'll probably put a spacer between their big toe and their second toe to try to hedge off that hallux valgus. That might help to some degree, but at what point do they really need to consider, is it again, come back to function and pain and how arthritic the joint is? And then at what point are they they've passed the point of when it will be helpful? So at what point is the sweet spot?
of before you start considering doing anything more involved. So really has to do with your pain. And then some of it's the deformity and the flexibility of the deformity. I think earlier on, I think folks can get away with wearing a wider toe box shoe, giving it more room. Orthotic can help elevate the arch, and then maybe take a little more pressure off that medial, off the big toe joint to help with the push off. The toe spacer is one where it's, it can help. It may not necessarily help. I don't usually recommend it as much just because it's not going to provide any definitive correction. But usually those are some of the main things I recommend. And then when it gets to that point where you're having pain despite all these things and you're having difficulty with shoe wear, when it gets to the point where shoe wear is a challenge, where you can't even wear the shoes, you're having difficulty finding shoes just because of the width of the bunion is causing the shoe wear to be really challenged to find shoes that fit you and that are not painful. And then it's if it's causing pain at night, because then you have folks who have there's so much pain that it causes pain at night and it keeps them up from sleep. So that's when we start talking about surgery. That's traditionally how I would counsel patients on how to proceed when you decide, hey, when do I fix this? Because again, if you can manage it with some of these other things, then you can avoid having a surgery.
So any words of advice for people in general of taking care of their feet just long term? Things that find yourself saying sometimes or wishing people knew?
Yeah. I usually recommend just telling patients just being mindful about their shoe wear. I think shoe wear is a big thing. It's kind of our barrier between our body and their environment, at least from the foot standpoint. Wearing sensible shoes, good supportive arches, having a good arch support can help prevent some problems and just kind of alleviate, offload certain, issues. And when I say wear sensible shoes, folks, a lot of times I see folks come in with really thin, like slipper type shoes, and that's what they wear a lot. Usually I'm recommending shoes that have a thicker sole. And I don't think everyone needs it, but the rocker bottom type shoes, one I recommend a lot, particularly for folks who have midfoot issues, forefoot issues. But, orthotic, good supportive shoe. And then when you're going to, and just from a, not just a foot standpoint, but just when you're, looking into get back into sports or just being active, like a lot of folks in this region, are doing outdoor stuff, you kind of want to prepare for it. Before you go out and go hiking or do really aggressive stuff, you kind of have to, like an athlete, train and kind of prepare yourself to do certain things as opposed to just jumping in and going and running that half marathon, which you normally haven't trained for or haven't really worked, prepared for, or going on a really intensive hiking trip and haven't really done a lot of the training to prepare yourself for that. So just being mindful of treating your body like an athlete and training and preparing for those more intense activities.
Yeah, people don't see, when they watch professional athletes perform, they watch the performance, but they don't see the hours that went into the warm up and the training. If professionals warm up for 2 hours before their event, then surely the rest of us should probably warm up for at least 20 minutes before our 3 mile run.
Exactly.
Or whatever. Yeah. I think that's probably a big one, is just not adequate warm up. And, I try to educate them that, we don't, as we age every passing decade, it's almost like our body needs more time to warm up than
Absolutely.
It used to. Kids are warm all the time, but not adults.
Right. No, if you're, 10, 15, 18 years old, you can go run half a marathon, cold and, for a lot of kids. But as we get older, you have to stretch. You have to really take the time, be very deliberate about stretching, warming up and training and conditioning your body to do the things you want to do.
Yeah. Investment so that you can keep doing what it is that you want to do. And that's kind of what I educate all my, when they're done with PT, they're never really done.
Yeah.
I'm sending them with, okay, now going forward, these top five things you're going to do at least a couple times a week so that you don't have to come back again for something else or the same thing. But it's not, you're never done. It's kind of like, I liken it to the dentist. We all know we have to brush and floss our teeth twice a day. For muscle skeletal health, what are you doing so that you can go do your, marathon or whatever it is? So they seem to... That analogy seems to work for me.
Yeah.
The dental one.
That's a good point. I need to borrow that one.
Yeah, that one's a good one. So, thanks so much on all that information. I think those are all great, great points. I do think the shoe wear, I have noticed many times with patients when they're here, I have them take off their shoes and I look at the bottom of them and point off like how like one side is totally worn off and they're walking on a beveled edge. And that seems to click to them of like the, if you're wearing shoes, I know we all have shoes we really love to wear and wear and wear, but it's no longer providing you support and shock absorption. So that's a big one that I see all the time. So yeah. Everybody take your shoes off and look at the bottoms of them, see if they need to be replaced. So here's some fun wrap-up questions. What is your favorite restaurant in the South Sound?
Wow, that's a good one. You know, I like seafood. I'm a big seafood. I really like it, and that's one of the reasons I came here. One of the reasons I wanted to come here. But I really like Chelsea Farms. Their seafood's great in that 222 Market downtown.
Yep, that's a good one. Yeah, what is on your bucket list to do in the South Sound that you've not done yet?
So far, I've already caught a gooey duck. But dug for a gooey duck. I have a lot of things I want to do, but salmon fishing is on there, and catching some salmon is something I'm planning on doing.
Good. Yeah. What's your favorite place or thing to do so far in the South Sound outside that you would recommend?
That is a good one. Also, I really like, one of the reasons I came here because I like being by the water. I'm a kind of coastal person, so that's why I've been like, you know, Florida, raised in New York, went to Baltimore, you know, for my training. So I like being on the coast, and so just going out to the water, you know, in the Puget Sound, just kind of going just to different spots, and just taking it all in. I mean, we have some great views here. I don't know how lucky, some of us don't know how lucky we are being in this area.
Yeah,
you know, living in a lot of different places in the country. And you know, there are pluses and minuses at every place, but one of the pluses here is just the outdoors, there's the beauty. Driving up to this exit here and you see Mount Rainier in the back, it's just like, you know, you don't get this everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's one of your best tips for people to stay healthy and fit in the South Sound? You kind of answered it a little bit already, but.
Yeah, I mean, I would just kind of reiterate the just trying to be conditioned and or try to condition yourself to do the things you want to do just to maintain your shape, even if you're going to do a 5K. You know, it's kind of hard to right now. If I were to do a 5K, I'm kind of a little bit out of shape, so I'd have to really feel like I want to prepare for it before I went and did that. So just doing, you know, small things to prepare yourself for the bigger activities.
All right. Well, and where else can people find more about you? Because you're at which location at Olympia Orthopedics?
At the Eastside location right by St. Peter's Hospital.
And then there's a little bit of a bio on the website. So the website.
Yeah, or oleortho.com website. There's my bio's there. And then also I'm kind of active on Twitter and Instagram. So there are fun ways to connect with patients and put out information about orthopedic sports medicine.
Good. You know, that I post. You on Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah. I think you just search, I don't even remember what my handle is. It's like Richard Lamore, MD. But if you just kind of Google or you search it in those avenues, you'd
see. They'll find you.
Yeah, they'll find me, yeah.
Okay, great. All right. Well, thanks so much for coming and doing this podcast.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me. It's been, hopefully I have some good information. And if there's any questions, definitely reach out.
Sounds good. All right. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Stay Healthy South Sound podcast, brought to you by Penrose & Associates Physical Therapy. If you want some free tips to implement right away on various problems like knee pain, back pain, running injuries, and many more issues, then jump on over to penrosept.com and download the free report that fits your needs. You will receive helpful tips right away and have the choice to email in for further questions and set up a free phone consultation. You can reach us at 360-456-1444 and info@penrosept.com. You can stay connected with us at stayhealthysouthsound.com and subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the Stay Healthy South Sound podcast. This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.